station number 4299, reel 2.
Sergeant Hayes, Reel 2. Can we turn that to your conditions of service? How many tours was it customary to serve?
Well, you originally went out for a tour of 18 months, and subject to being satisfactory, and also, of course, you liking the life out there, you could take two further tours before you return back to your British Regiment. When I got out there, I was promoted to sergeant, as I was only corporal in my own British Regiment, and we had at that time the regiment sergeant major, company sergeant major, and two quartermaster sergeants, and five platoon sergeants, which made up the British NCOs of the 2nd Battalion. These were divided into a quarter company and number one and number two companies. And Mr. McCabe, who was the RSM, put the newest platoon sergeants alongside of the oldest African sergeants there, who taught you their customs as you was teaching them military traditional work, you know. And it was very good system, because these old sergeants was quite proud and had quite a lot of self-reliance, and they could explain family and tribal traditions to you, which you'd have never picked up without their guidance, you know.
Were they very complicated? And did you feel...
No, they was... they had quite a good idea of... military life, you know, and some of them had actually been to England for the coronation parade. They, of course, saw in a short space of time what our own conditions were, and they used to explain to us the conditions in which they lived. Most of them came from quite a good field away, and this was where the recruits came from. They used to send out a party to go up into the Northern Territories. And
why were the Northern Territories chosen?
Well, they was more or less the traditional training ground for the Gold Coast troops. The ones down at the coast, you didn't used to take the coast boys at all.
Why was that?
I don't know, really. I think it was the fact that, one, they didn't care for military life. There was lots of them was fishermen. And secondly, they weren't all that amenable to discipline. Whereas the farmer chap who came from the Northern Territories, he was amenable to discipline, and it was an entirely different life for him. And when he was selected by these... recruiting parties, it was consisted entirely of the natives. They weren't any British with them, and they used to bring these chaps back, most from family life, and they, you know, had a tribal life, and they was then trained by their actual own tribal people, you see, and
Were they split up into tribes, would you say?
Pardon?
Were they split up into tribes, or did they mix the tribes?
Yeah, there was all mixed in, yes. There were no actual real tribal priorities in the battalion. I mean, they just took the luck and went into wherever they want. I mean, if you had 20 recruits there, well, they'd probably go 10 to one company and 10 to another after they'd been trained.
How many recruits would you tend to pick up every year, say?
Well, it all depends. You see, once you've got the full battalion strength, the losses due to leaving the service was only by old age or sickness. Because once the chap joined the army, that was his life, and he didn't ever think of leaving until he was too old to do things, you know. So it was only occasionally that you had these large influxes of recruits coming to you. Some of them had come up from Kumasi to make up the battalion numbers where the depot was. But the ones that was trained actually with the 2nd Battalion, that was the ones up in Tamney itself, were more or less all family from previous soldiers in the regiment.
There was a very strong family tradition.
Oh, yes, yeah, it's tribal. Mm. Yeah, the Farrafarras was quite a strong tribe, and they most of those chaps over the years became NCOs. Very good people, sensible.
How efficient were the African NCOs?
Very good indeed, yes. They could be relied on far more to get the men amenable to military life than what you'd normally expect from them.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, in Britain, it used to take 26 weeks training to make a chap from civil life into a half-fledged soldier before he went to his battalion. But out there, we could get these chaps to the same standard of efficiency in 16 weeks. And this wasn't all due to the British influence at all. A lot of it was due to the African influence, who had such pride, and they wouldn't allow them to let the battalion or the regiment down. You know, they frowned on it very much if anyone made a mistake.
They had quite a sharp sense of the regimental honour.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
And what was your role exactly if the African NCOs were doing so much of the training themselves?
Well, we used to take these young NCOs, say the Lance Corporals and Corporals, with a squad of men, and we would let them take, say, 2 periods of drill under our supervision. If there was had to be checked, we would do it very nicely, you know. Then in rifle training or any kind of weapon training, we would explain the lesson to be given to them, and if there was any possibility of not understanding, the native NCO would tell them in their own language, you see.
Did this often happen?
Oh, fairly often, yes, yeah. And of course most of them had a great sense of pidgin English, despite the fact that the Hausa was the recognised language. They could speak pidgin, which was very handy when you went out, then you didn't know their language, you know. And they was taught English. There was a schoolmaster who used to take the recruits into school. And
was this
they
the
was
Munchie?
Pardon?
Was this the Munchie?
Munchie, yes, that's
why
right.
Why was he called that? I have heard the word.
I don't know. I think just something that it's a breakdown of some form of Hausa. But it's not a colloquial term at all. It was one that was generally used throughout, you know, and the schoolmaster became a munchie, I don't know why. But he used to teach them, and they'd have English lessons, and he'd teach them about the regiment's history and what they've done, you know, things of this nature. Also teach them about geography of certain places in Africa and things of this nature, which we might have to go to an adventure. Of course, they did have to go there. But they got a good grounding in the school by this man. He wasn't a soldier, but he was well respected and looked up to by the troops.
Yeah. And how much of the sort of teaching did they receive each day?
An hour, mostly. They'd break it off first thing in the morning. They'd start the day off by PT or a cross-country run, and then they would do a certain amount of weapon training, like possibly a rifle, or even go down on the range and do a shoot, you know. And it was divided right up through the day until 12 o'clock. Then in the afternoons they used to do the normal interior welfare and
fatigues
of this nature. You know,
what, grass cutting?
Yeah, grass cutting or wood cutting or clearing up. Favourite job for the defaulters was to sweep this dusty road in front of the colonel's office. Yes, that was a dusty old job. They didn't like that. And wood fatigues, getting wood in for the cookhouse and things of that nature.
What sort of field craft did you practice?
Oh, well, the general field infantry craft at that time, you'd go out on manoeuvres, and one company would be the enemy of the Red Army or something, the other one would be the other, and the British NCOs used to act as umpires as see how they reacted to the various tests that was given to them, you know, like tactical exercises that they had to do, and we used to do umpires.
What sort of things? Can you give some examples?
Well, for instance, it was a simple thing. They'd ask them, and a section NCO would be expected to know the angle of going to attack a small village, for instance. He had to capture a village, or he knew the enemy was in this village, and he was given a brief description of the strength of the enemy and what guns he had, and he had to try and find his own solution of how to get there to capture it. Now, to my mind, this, to an African, was a good test of his ability, because a lot of British NCOs couldn't always come up with the answers, you know. And most of these fellas could use quite a lot of ingenuity and imagination. And they used to look at it with great fun. It was a great game to them, especially if they got the other fella rattled and they won. They was really delighted, like children, really. And then, of course, once a year we used to go out on battalion manoeuvres, when full battalion would go out, and we'd stop out for 3 or 4 weeks in different training grounds. You know, we'd probably do a bit of training for bush warfare or desert warfare, things of that nature.
What sort of training would you do for desert warfare?
Well, mostly the same as what we came up against in the end, of course, but that was finding your way about by compass and by the stars at night and things, and coming across and fighting, making use of ground cover and various tactical ways of getting to the enemy. But most of them were good at finding the way by night, which was quite an accomplishment, because on a dark night, and you get the occasional star, and you've got to guard yourself from that, they was quite good at it. And We should show them the different stars and what they had to look for, you know, in which direction it would come. And of course, it had a great guiding factor there by the fact you had the Southern Cross, and they could find their way across anywhere. These chaps are very good.
I've heard it said that African soldiers brought a sort of hunting instinct to the army. Do you think that's true, or do you think that what they learned was quite new to them?
Actually, it didn't matter how well disciplined they were. The hunting instinct was there, because you'd be marching along down a road or something, and what they called meat had suddenly appear. It might be a fox or a hare or anything, and all the discipline just vanished. It was away off the road chasing this thing, you see. And if whoever got the meat, they were all well away, you know. But that was the only time when they ever did lose discipline, when they saw anything like that. And yes, they were born hunters, I think.
What with the sense of tactics in the chase, presumably this all helped in your field craft exercise?
I think it did. Not to the extent one would expect, though. I think the fact was that it was drilled into them so obviously what they had to do, you know, the things to look for in various tactical exercises. But their hunting instinct did come in to assist them in lots of ways. Yes, it did.
Did you ever have to do any water training, going long periods of time without water?
Well, no, we didn't do a lot of that, quite candidly. I don't think it would have been fair, because we always used to have the ice box with our bottles of beer in it. You know, with every halt we stopped at, we'd have a bottle of beer, so I don't think it would be quite fair on the African, would it?
Who had the beer? Just the NCOs? Or
everybody? Yeah. It's just stop at, you know, every hour and have a quick cold beer. And the carriers used to always have your bedroll and things along. You see, they had a carrier platoon, and the mess boys used to come along at the back of that with a table and a few folding chairs and glasses, and you'd sit down and have a 10-minute break. Yeah.
Was the training affected by seasonal changes in the weather?
Yes. Yeah.
In what way? Yeah.
Well, for instance, once the rains came, there was very little chance of doing any training outside, because you'd be saturated in a few minutes, and that was a time when there was devoted to internal economy, like making up mattings and things for the store roofs and stuff, and they'd be taught various things about battles that had been fought, you know, and explained to them on the blackboard and things of that nature. Then in the dry season, of course, when all the heavy training was done, we used to leave the camp altogether and go out in the bush and that on training.
How long would these
be? Well, the most we ever be away would be about 3 weeks at the outside, most of them. Then there'd be the period for their annual firing on the ranges, go out teaching and firing. And they learned to fire not only the rifle, which was their primary weapon, but the Lewis gun and mortars. All these annual tests which you had to do. It followed very much similarly the training you get with the British troops in India.
How literate were the African NCOs? Did they have to be able to read and write, or could they get away without?
No, they used to read and write, and all of them did. And this was one of the things where which impress you, really, that they were so keen to learn, you know? I mean, anything that was there that they could pick up they show great keenness in achieving it. You showed them something and they'd keep going at it until they'd mastered it. Well, they're very keen.
What was the role of the British officer in all this? You haven't mentioned this at all. Did he
well,
not impinge on your life, or did he?
Well, yes, I mean, it was much the same. There would be records and all this constant paperwork that had to be done and training programs made up. But the officers attended parades two or three times a week. They'd be on the battalion parade. But generally, they was confined to company record business and whatnot, and the NCOs would report to them what was happening, and then of course discipline matters was always brought before the officers, but there again all depended, because with the native regimental sergeant major, I mean, he could be a tower of strength to him, because lots of the trivial troubles that arose in the lines was dealt with by him. Never went to the company commander at all.
What sort of trivial troubles would they be?
Well, I mean, there was lots of times when you'd get to trouble with the difference between the single fellas and the soldiers who got the wives there, you know, and things of that nature, or petty pilfering might happen. And lots of times the RSM himself dealt with this, and it was dealt with very judiciously, and there was no need for any British person to come into knowledge of it. Mm-hmm. Only when it was a serious crime, like being asleep on guard or something of the nature of that, that it never got to the British officers.
Did you deal with any of these sort of problems on your own initiative, or did you always pass up and refer these problems to the officer?
No, he'd inform the British RSM.
You know. I see.
There's a very close affinity between the two of them. As a matter of fact, that those two, in actual fact, used to rule the battalion. You know, everyone else's life was made simple by the fact that those two really were the linchpin of the battalion.
Yes, I see. Did you see much of the officers on training exercises?
Oh, yes. The RSM, the native RSM, was a very proud man. When I joined him, he'd already done his 21 year service when he was still serving. And of course, when hostilities broke out, he was fairly old then. And he went down to the regimental depot in Kumasi. He didn't go to active service. But I think he would have liked to do him if they'd let him, you know. Very, very smart man, very likable man.
Did you see much of the African NCOs when you were off duty?
Oh, yes, we used to play sport together, yeah. Play football and hockey and things like that, yeah.
You taught the troops these games?
Yeah.
Did they like them?
Oh, yes, they loved it, yeah. Well, there was plenty of opportunity for sports, you know, for them. And they used to take part, yes. Great. Sometimes.
What else did you do with your social life in your off-duty hours?
Oh, well, mostly it was a kind of a very confined lives. There's only the doctor and the public works engineer down in the town that we ever used to associate with, because funnily enough we didn't go and we weren't really accepted by the mission people.
Why not? They
kept much themselves. Most of the missions was American missions, or else Catholic nuns and priests, you know. But down the town there was a public works engineer and a doctor who he was a civilian doctor, but he used to look after the troops as well, you know. And we'd go down to their place for drinks and dinner, and they'd return and come up to the mess where we had section there. Made a lot of our own fun and games. We'd have little evenings when we'd make up, say, the London street scene, and we'd have a bar outside the mess with hamburgers and sausage rolls and all this nonsense on, and we'd invite the officers and the wives along, and each person who came had to dress up as a character in London, you know. Sometimes they'd have someone dressed up as a flower seller, right, the old ladies with their big bonnets, and where the dickens they got the bonnets from, I never found out. But then you'd have the
where did they get the
newsboy, you know, shouting out the news and that, and we'd have an old gas lamp fixed up there and have the newsboy standing up under the gas lamp shouting evening news and standard, and we'd have a few quiet drinks and, you know, really enjoy ourselves. We'd have the old records going on the gramophone, and these little evenings, there were nothing in them themselves, but it got you together and broke down any officer NCO feeling for a time, you know. Acted like normal people abroad, English people abroad do, and they often caused a lot of fun amongst the troops, because they come along and stand by the hedgerow and watch it and enjoy the great fun to see them all acting daft, you know. Especially if they saw the RSM acting daft, that was a wonderful thing.
Did you ever miss London?
Did I? No. I enjoyed the life. I wasn't really amiss at the fact there was no real life there. I mean, we had our own mess, and we had records to play and things of that nature, and books, good training. Times when we was on exercises, we could read up our manuals and things and study and all that. No, I didn't miss the social life at all. I thought it was quite nice out there. I enjoyed it.
What was your pay at the time?
Well, we was on special colonial pay. As far as I remember correctly, it was on something like about £380 a year, which was quite a figure in those days.
Were you able to save much?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
What bank did you use?
At the time, it was with Barclays DC and Air. Yes. Yeah. And life was pretty good. I mean, it wasn't a very expensive country to live in.